people who are currently living effectively on largesse from the surplus generated from the oil revenue, are we willing to work at wages that are far below the level of living they're currently getting, just strikes me as laughable. And I can see quite strong revolts by the youth of Saudi Arabia if they find this is the fate they face.
At the same time, the standards of living are declining in the kingdom. To the dismay of Saudi citizens, VAT, or value-added tax, was introduced for the first time in 2018 and trebled in 2020. To worsen the situation for the citizens, Riyadh has reduced fuel subsidies and scrapped a cost of living allowance. Vehicle sales over the past 5 years can serve as a barometer of tumbling standards of living in Saudi Arabia. A report by the World Bank in 2020 shows 800,000 cars were sold in 2015, 400,000 in 2018, and 300,000 in 2020. The alarm was sounded for the Saudi economy in 2014, when the state spending and royal extravagance outpaced revenues, and therefore the Saudis were forced to turn to the international markets. It is estimated that by the end of 2021, the kingdom's debts will add up to 50% of its GDP.
Generally speaking, it's Saudi Arabia. If any country on the planet was dependent upon the oil age, it was Saudi Arabia. And with the oil age ending quite possibly this next couple of years, then so is its economic fortune. It reminds me to some extent of Nauru, which became a wealthy country in the Pacific Islands by exporting superphosphate, which tried to ensure for the future by building up financial reserves from those superphosphate exports. But the superphosphate finally ran out, and the reserves were largely wiped out by a financial crisis with some bad investments, and now it's an impoverished nation in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Saudi Arabia may be a much larger impoverished nation in the middle of the Middle East, and that's not a recipe for anybody's happiness anywhere on the planet.
The Saudi faltering economy is mirrored in the unfinished Kingdom Tower, known also as the Jeddah Tower. Initiated by Prince Al-Walid bin Talal's Kingdom Holdings, the construction of the tower began in 2013 and was expected to be completed by 2020. But so far, only a quarter of the tower has been built. The huge, uncompleted building looming over Jeddah is the embarrassing embodiment of an economy which has seen better days and has to keep tight control over the purse strings in the coming years.
O rotator of hearts and eyes, O regulator of the day and night, O transformer of the state and conditions, turn our state into the best of states.
Nowruz is the message of peace and friendship by the Iranians for the whole world. Happy Nowruz!
Limelight.
CO2
Batu is not a lone actor. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "We're Destroying Our Life Support Systems." Studies suggest the Amazon now contributes to warming. Stay tuned for the details, please. While recent research has raised alarm that tropical forests, including the Amazon, could soon stop serving as carbon sinks, a first-of-its-kind study from 30 experts that takes into account other greenhouse gases suggests the world's largest rainforest may already be contributing to the warming of the planet. The new analysis, published recently in the journal Frontiers in Forest and Global Change, considers not only carbon dioxide, CO2, and its impact on the global climate, but also that of methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, N20, black carbon, biogenic volatile organic compounds, BVOCs, aerosols, evapotranspiration, and albedo. What the authors do that's important is to expand the conversation beyond carbon dioxide, which is what 90% of public conversation is centered around. Patrick Meganigo, Associate Director of Research at Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, told National Geographic, CO2 is not a lone actor, added Meganigo, who was cited in but not involved with the research, which was funded by the National Geographic Society. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. As 15-year-old climate activist Alexandria Villasnor put it in a tweet about the study, we are destroying our life support systems. We are running out of time. The recent study notes that after a transient period of reduced deforestation and increased optimism, rising agricultural conversion and illegal logging activities are again accelerating Amazonian forest loss. This resurgence has renewed concerns that the region is rapidly approaching a catastrophic tipping point. Data from the Rainforest Foundation Norway revealed recently that human activities have destroyed 34% of old-growth tropical rainforest and degraded 30% worldwide. Over half of that destruction since 2002 has been in the Amazon and neighboring South American rainforest. Under Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, whose country is home to the majority of the Amazon, deforestation hit a 12-year high in 2020. Cutting the forest is interfering with its carbon uptake. That's a problem. Christopher Covey, lead author of the new study and a professor of environmental studies at Skidmore College, told National Geographic. But when you start to look at these other factors alongside CO2, it gets really hard to see how the net effect isn't that the Amazon as a whole is really warming global climate. The study says that despite some uncertainty, we conclude that current warming from non-CO2 agents, especially CH4 and N2O, in the Amazon basin largely offsets and most likely exceeds the climate service provided by atmospheric CO2 uptake. We also find that the majority of anthropogenic impacts act to increase the radioactive forcing potential of the basin. Given the large contribution of less recognized agents, the paper continues, noting that Amazonian trees alone emit about 3.5% of all global CH4, focusing strictly on carbon uptake and storage is incompatible with genuine efforts to understand and manage the biochemistry of climate in a rapidly changing Amazon basin. Covey and his colleagues told National Geographic that reversing the damage that's already been done will require halting emissions from fossil fuels around the world and reining in Amazon deforestation, along with reducing dam building and increasing efforts to replant trees. The Amazon is among the most biodiverse places on the planet. The ongoing coronavirus pandemic has highlighted the importance of conserving and restoring rainforest, not only because of the climate emergency, but also to prevent future zoonotic disease outbreaks. As the pandemic, officially declared a year ago, has killed more than 2.6 million people and sickened over 119 million worldwide, experts from across the globe have repeatedly called on humanity to heal its broken relationship with nature.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S., quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. Every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada's the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, their governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his Go It Alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance in China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm quote speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says the evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the U.S. or the U.K. and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and, of course, the attack on Syria. This is... the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council. And, it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defense of war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on six Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The U.S. and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country.
Thank you.
Iran's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why the analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria for the war. Of course, you know, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Plus American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, and you know, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. Figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired, they are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
Of 17 countries have united in defense of the United Nations Charter. The group seeks to form a coalition to promote multilateralism and counter the use or the threat of force and sanctions against other UN member states. The coalition, known as the Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the United Nations, includes Iran, China, Russia, Palestine, Syria, Venezuela, North Korea, and Cuba, as well as several other countries. The group has called for dialogue, tolerance, and solidarity. And these are the core of international relations and vital for the peaceful coexistence among nations. The group's concept notes said unprecedented attacks against multilateralism have put the global peace and security in jeopardy, adding that imposition of coercive measures and the withdrawal from global agreements were signs of growing unilateralism. That is while all 17 members of the group were under sanctions during the former U.S. President Donald Trump's time in office. For instance, the Trump administration imposed sanctions against Iran over its peaceful nuclear program, China over alleged technology theft, and Russia over the 2014 integration of Crimea. Under Trump, Washington announced plans to quit the World Health Organization, pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council, the UN Cultural Agency UNESCO, the Paris Climate Change Accord, and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has pledged to reverse Washington's previous course as he rescinded the withdrawal from the World Health Organization and returned the U.S. to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. However, Biden has maintained the sanctions already in place against Iran, as well as against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Syria, and other countries involved in the 17-party Group of Friends, proving that Washington has no plans to put an end to its hostile and illegal sanctions.
I think it's a very significant move. The United States announced after President Biden's inauguration that we were back on the world scene. And I think expected that everybody would make a sigh of relief and everything would be fine. But I don't think that's quite what's happened here. The Chinese and the Russians and, 17 other nations or more have signed this declaration to work through the United Nations to end the kind of unilateralism, unilateral interference in foreign affairs. Clearly, that's aimed at the United States.
Members of the Group of Friends Coalition have railed against Washington's sanctions and intervention in various statements. A good example of Washington's unilateralism is its withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal unilaterally and rescinded hundreds of sanctions against Tehran. Since the U.N. Security Council Resolution 1737 was passed in 2006, the U.S. and the European Union have been the biggest supporters of sanctions against Iran in order to hamper its peaceful nuclear program. They have both passed numerous bills to impose ever harsher sanctions, including Washington's failed maximum pressure campaign. Last month, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. sanctions against Iran have inflicted the country's economy with $1 trillion worth of damage. China has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop its illegal unilateral sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, Russia has slammed the anti-Iran sanctions by Washington, calling them anti-human. However, despite being a failed policy, Washington continues its futile approach. According to the report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period.
After all, if we talk about the Middle East, it was the United States who withdrew from the nuclear accords. That's an act of hostility. And then to blame the Iranians and say, unless they do something, we're not going to come back. I mean, this is the kind of double standard we face. And it is one that's going to have to be overcome politically in this country before there's going to be a change.
A recent report by the Washington Post revealed that the U.S. has attempted to change other nations' governments 72 times between the years 1947 and 1989 during the Cold War. Finally, when the U.S. continues to apply sanctions for its own political gains and gets away with it, or when the Israeli regime breaks the most U.N. resolutions, essentially making the resolutions ineffective, doesn't that put the U.N. institution's purpose under question?
All Persian-speaking listeners of IRIB English Radio. Happy Nowruz! Happy the beginning of spring!
Nowruz Special. Spring has come and has revived the frozen nature. As nature has rejuvenated, our souls are revived too. Migrating swallows are coming back, singing their songs. Nightingales are singing in chorus the sweet song of love. Nature is wearing its colorful garment. Trees have woken up and are celebrating the feast of friendship and happiness. Let us rise and breathe in fresh air, the air of spring. In the special supplication, for a new year, as clock chimes in the new year, we ask God Almighty to change our state to the best of states. Now the question is, what is the best state, and when does our state become the best? The answer to this question is found in nature. If we look at nature, we will find it. Spring comes and breathes fresh life into the dead body of trees and plants. Beautiful nature not only creates picturesque sights for eyes, but also it refreshes the soul, and it gives new energy to the heart and to the spirit. Human heart sometimes becomes frosty and gloomy like winter. Lack of affection permeates its veins of spirit and makes man frustrated and melancholic. But the nature teaches us that we can move from a frosty and dark land to a green and spring land. We can go on towards sunset and create development. Nature is generous and kind. Spring generously spreads its green cloth everywhere. Religion teaches us that every move and development is from God. Thus, man should seek help from God for any development and appeal to God for the best state. The Almighty says in Ayah 186 of Surah Baqarah in the Holy Quran, "And when my servants ask you about me, I am indeed near. I answer the supplicant's call when he calls me. So let them respond to me, and let them have faith in me, so that they may fare rightly." Islamic narrations say prayer and supplication is the key to the divine mercy and a luminous lamp for enlightening the darkness in the world and the hereafter. The supplication at the start of the new year is indeed asking God to make us good servants through linking to whatever is good and shunning whatever is evil. Spring inspires us to return to our godly nature and spread godly virtues. Nowruz, Iranians and all those nations and ethnicities who celebrate Nowruz sit together around the Hafsin table. Hafsin tablecloth consists of seven items, beginning with the Persian letter Sin, which is equivalent to S in English. Each of these items symbolizes a phenomena. Sabze is green sprouts, is a symbol of rebirth and revival. Samanu is wheat sprout pudding, is a symbol of bounty and plenitude. Sumac is a symbol of sunrise. Seker or coin is a symbol of wealth. Sib or apple is a symbol of beauty and health. Serker or vinegar is a symbol of patience and life. And sir or garlic is a symbol of treatment or medicine. In addition to these seven items, Muslims place the Holy Quran too on the tablecloth, meaning that they consider this book as a role model for their lives. People in different regions and different countries add other items to the Hafsin tablecloth. They often put a mirror to symbolize purity and sincerity. The moment that the clock chimes in the new year is very significant for Iranians. Many people prefer to be in holy places, like the shrines of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, or Imamzadeh's descendants of these Imams. That's why the holy shrine of Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza, peace be upon him, in the holy city of Mashhad, in northeastern Iran, and Lady Ma'sumeh, Imam Reza's sister, peace be upon her, in the city of Qom, are always overcrowded at this time of the year. However, since the coronavirus outbreak, the number of pilgrims has decreased. People try to spend their time with prayer and supplication at the moment of the new year. Moreover, most people try to be with their grandparents at this time of the year too. Then they start going to each other's homes. It is customary that the younger folks pay a visit to the elders of their family, and this will be reciprocated. seconds tick away, and the start of the new year beckons. The eldest in the family, a grandfather for example, opens the Holy Quran and gives new banknotes that have already been placed in the pages of the Holy Quran to members of the family. This is called AD. Young children are very eager to get this. Of course, they prefer to receive a toy from their grandparents. Then everybody is engaged in eating nuts and fruits. Although the coronavirus outbreak has reduced these gatherings, people try to keep these traditions, Nowruz traditions, whilst observing health protocols such as wearing face masks and refraining from shaking hands or kissing one another. Nowruz is the beginning of the new solar Hijri year. This year is the beginning of the 15th century under Iranian Persian calendar. COVID-19 has impacted gatherings, but it has failed to affect affection and love. On the contrary, people have become more loving towards each other, especially those whose job has been seriously affected by the outbreak of this disease. We do not lose hope, and we have learned from the Holy Quran that most surely, with every hardship, there is ease.
Sanctions are a topic that often go underreported. They're seen by most people as being some kind of tame, mild alternative to war. But they're just as destructive as war, if not more. They're a modern equivalent of siege warfare, just like when armies would surround a city, cutting off its food supplies and isolating the inhabitants until they either surrendered or died of malnutrition and disease. Today, I want to talk about two countries, Venezuela and Syria, that are subject to some of the worst sanctions, although they're not the only ones. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States has been trying to topple the governments of Venezuela and Syria for a while now. Independent socialist countries who refuse to serve the financial and geopolitical interests of the United States usually do end up being couped, invaded, or sanctioned, sometimes all three. After all, this isn't something new. There isn't a country in Central or Latin America that the United States hasn't meddled in. We've seen the United States overthrow the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. We saw a CIA-backed coup in Chile in 1973. The United States was financing death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1980s, bombing Grenada in 1983, and much more. It's quite an extensive list. And it's important, of course, to underline this and point out the recent history, just so that there's no illusions of what's going on here. The United States and their partners are interested in regime change and will do so for economic reasons, as they have done so in the past. Again, it's no coincidence that Venezuela, besides being an anti-imperialist socialist nation, also happens to sit on the world's largest reserves of oil. Now, sanctions against Venezuela date back to the days of the Bush regime. Every U.S. president since has taken steps to expand the embargo on Venezuela. In 2014 and 2015, Barack Obama imposed further sanctions on Venezuela, freezing assets and issuing travel bans. Then when Donald Trump took over as president, he imposed even more sanctions as part of his maximum pressure campaign. In January 2019, Trump targeted Venezuela's oil sector. The oil embargo included the Trump administration blocking sales from Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, and then seizing its U.S. subsidiary, Citgo, which is worth billions. Remember, Venezuela relies heavily on its exports of oil for that stream of revenue, and Trump also proceeded to target its financial sector in March 2019 and its defense and security sector in May 2019. Now, although the United States claims it imposes sanctions to punish certain government officials and ministers for, you know, alleged human rights abuses and cracking down on protesters, something the United States has no problem doing on its own citizens, the United States isn't acting as some kind of benevolent moral arbiter. It wants to replace the Venezuelan government with someone more favorable to the interests of Washington, D.C., which is why the United States has been propping up the former leader of the National Assembly in Venezuela, Juan Guaido. This guy, who most Venezuelans haven't even heard of, is essentially their stooge. He's a puppet that they want to put in place in order to further their political and economic interests. As per usual, the European Union followed the lead of the United States and also imposed sanctions on Venezuela and also proceeded to push Juan Guaido as a supposed interim president of Venezuela. Now, whatever issues Venezuela had internally, these sanctions have only served to exacerbate them and as a result have spurred on one of the worst displacement crises in the world. According to the United Nations, worldwide, there are over 5 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants and over 800,000 asylum seekers and 2.5 million living under other legal forms of stay in the Americas. Sanctions make life hell for the people living there, and this is precisely why so many people are fleeing. The poverty rate has reached record levels and plunged the Venezuelan people into unimaginably cruel conditions. Since Venezuela's economy is so heavily dependent on oil, by blocking Venezuela from selling its oil and stealing its companies, the U.S. is essentially cutting off funding for social services and government infrastructure. They know this, and they do this anyway, hoping that the people will rise up and overthrow their government. To further examine the harsh realities of economic sanctions, I'm joined by Alina Duhan. She is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral course of measures on the enjoyment of human rights, or sanctions. She's also a professor of international law at the Belarusian State University, and she just returned recently from Venezuela. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the program, Professor. It's good to have you.
It's a pleasure for me.
I wanted to ask you if you could maybe further explain the mechanism of how these sanctions can end up being so devastating for the local currency of another country and freezing the assets as well and so forth. And also how that ties into Syria, because the Syrian pound is also experiencing this hyperinflation, specifically after the implementation of the Caesar Act sanctions in June 2020.
The economic situation as well as hyperinflation started to develop in Venezuela as soon as the oil prices started to drop, starting from 2013. So there was a serious economic decrease. And the hyperinflation has already started at that point. When we speak about Syria, the Syrian economy has already been devastated by years of conflict over the years. So we need to take into account that situation was already far, far from good one before sanctions have been imposed. Countries, for example, Venezuela can't sell oil anymore. If you compare with 2015 and 2016, when sanctions started to be imposed, the revenue of Venezuela from selling oil dropped from 100% to 1%. So they started to get only 1% of the money they used to get because of selling oil. The mining sector of Venezuela has also been listed, and therefore they can't sell anything, can't export anything they used to get from the mining sector as well. That's why the income has dropped even further. That the assets Venezuela had in the banks of the United States, United Kingdom, and Portugal, which upon different assessments were between $5 and $6 billion, have been frozen. The country is losing income and can't pay to social services. And as a result, a lot of social projects which used to be supported by the government, in particular, the government used to provide 2 meals per day at schools, so children were fed at schools. Now it's limited to 1, and this 1 is usually very small. It doesn't contain protein, so children do not eat at schools anymore.
And how would you describe the medical and public health infrastructure in Venezuela at the moment? How much have these institutions been further imperiled, generally speaking, by these sanctions?
Before 2016, the government used to provide the full coverage of medical expenses to every citizen of Venezuela. I was visiting the cardiological child hospital. Traditionally, this hospital was doing 1,500 surgeries, heart surgeries for children per year. Last year, this hospital was only able to do 160 surgeries. So it basically means that more than 1,300 children were not able to get this surgery. I was visiting the hospitals both in Caracas and outside of Caracas. And I have been reported that in some of them, they can't even do, for example, the simple blood test because all the centrifuges are already broken. The majority of hospitals demonstrate that about 80% of equipment is already broken because it's impossible to buy spare parts for the equipment. And traditionally, Venezuela was buying the equipment either from the United States or from Europe. And that's a really serious problem.
You know, when the United States announced sanctions, they usually say that they're going to make an exception for humanitarian aid, for relief agencies. Does that actually translate into reality?
In practice, unfortunately, the majority of these humanitarian exceptions doesn't work. First of all, the procedure to get a permission to deliver humanitarian aid is lengthy and costly. That means that only huge humanitarian organizations which have a necessary legal department can be involved into that. A small one can't even effort doing that. Secondly, even if there is a possibility to get a humanitarian exceptions, it still doesn't mean that a company will be able to buy humanitarian goods because of the fear of secondary sanctions. So the majority of banks and the majority of companies outside of the countries will be scared to be involved into transactions. That if you look, for example, at the guidances which have been developed by the European Union as concerned the delivery of humanitarian aid, the burden of proof of the initial humanitarian purpose is laying on humanitarian actors. So the humanitarian organizations face the following situation. They need to find the donors. They need to find a way to get an exception. They need to prove that these goods will be only be used for humanitarian purposes, and they will be responsible if anything will happen. That's why they prefer not to be involved that much in this sphere, and that's why I delivered the guidance on delivery of humanitarian aid at the end of 2020, and I called for some steps to be taken to improve situation with humanitarian exception. But the last point, which is also important, is that usually, even if it's possible to get humanitarian exception, these humanitarian exceptions are only referring to medical goods and to food. It's impossible to get a humanitarian exception to anything else. There are enormous problems, for example, to get humanitarian exceptions for something which could be considered as a dual-use goods. In Venezuela, there are serious problems with spare parts for the medical equipment, spare parts for water, electricity supply, as well as industry responsible for agriculture. And buying this equipment and buying these spare parts is not never considered to fall under humanitarian exceptions.
Alina Duhan, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure speaking with you, Professor.
It was a pleasure for me. Thank you for your interest.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Similarly to Venezuela, Syria has also been on the receiving end of brutal sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union, all done in the aim of toppling the Syrian government and effectuating regime change. Syria has undergone the world's worst refugee crisis in modern history. Half of Syria's population has been displaced by this war, even members of my own family. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, more than 6.6 million Syrians have been forced to flee their homes since 2011, and another 6.7 million people remain displaced inside the country. And on top of all that suffering, the European Union and the United States don't stop there. It's not enough that Western powers have funded armed groups inside Syria to sow chaos, or that Israel helped Al-Qaeda fighters because it suited them to see Syria fall. No, on top of all that, they go ahead and tighten the noose even further on the Syrian people. It's despicable. In June 2020, the Trump regime implemented the Caesar Act. These sanctions are the most severe and extensive sanctions Syria has ever faced, despite having been under sanctions for decades. Right now in Syria, people are queuing up in bread lines. Bread lines in a country that used to grow its own wheat and have enough wheat left over to export to other countries. People now have to wait hours just to get a little bit of bread that isn't even enough to properly feed a family. This wasn't a thing before the war. This was unheard of. People have drawn comparisons between what's happening now and the way hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were viciously starved to death by sanctions in the 1990s. Before the war on Syria started in 2011, one U.S. dollar was equal to 47 Syrian pounds. Now, $1 is equal to 4,000 Syrian pounds on the black market. This devaluation of the currency and hyperinflation brought on by the war and exacerbated by the Caesar sanctions has completely shattered Syria's economy. And of course, given that Lebanon and Syria's economies are inextricably intertwined, and Lebanon is going through its own economic crisis, that doesn't do much to help either. Not only is the United States isolating Syria from the world and cutting off its resources, it's also holding them hostage and occupying Syria's oil fields in the northeast and the breadbasket region where its crops are grown. Last year, Senator Lindsey Graham gleefully exclaimed his approval of the fact that the U.S. had signed a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF to steal Syria's oil, and even gloated about these sadistic Caesar Act sanctions, asking like some bloodthirsty monster whether more were coming.
The Caesar's Act, thank you for using it quickly and in a holding Assad son accountable is a great first step in what I think will be a long journey to punish this regime. Is more coming?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Great job.
According to the latest report from the World Food Program, a record 12.4 million Syrians, that's nearly 60% of the population, are now food insecure. In just over 1 year, an additional 4.5 million Syrians have become food insecure. Sean O'Brien, the World Food Program's representative and country director in Syria, said that the, quote, situation has never been worse. Basic foods to feed a family for a month, bread, rice, lentils, and oil and sugar, now cost at least 120,000 Syrian pounds, which far exceeds the average salaries. Over the last year, food prices across Syria have soared, and the price of basic items has increased by 236%, just as the value of the Syrian pound has plummeted. On average, the price of oil has increased from 1,000 Syrian pounds in January 2020 to 5,000 Syrian pounds in January 2021. UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan once again called on the United States to remove unilateral sanctions on Syria, saying, quote, the sanctions violate the human rights of the Syrian people, whose country has been destroyed by almost 10 years of ongoing conflict. The broad sweep of the United States sanctions law that went into effect in June could target any foreigner helping in reconstruction of the devastated country and even employees of foreign companies and humanitarian operators helping rebuild Syria. To talk more about these brutal Caesar Act sanctions that are gripping the Syrian population, journalist Vanessa Bealey joins me from Damascus. Vanessa, thank you for taking the time. I know you don't have a lot of electricity at the moment, ironically, because of the sanctions. How are you doing?
I love how they always term, when I say they, of course, I'm talking about the U.S. coalition, the U.S., U.K., EU, who are imposing these sanctions on the Syrian people. Let's make this really clear. You know, sanctions never target what our governments tell you that they are targeting. They target the people, some of the poorest and some of the most destabilized, traumatized people who have already gone through a 10-year war. You know, the first point I have to make is that Al-Qaeda are not under sanctions. The SDF are not under sanctions. ISIS are not under sanctions inside Syria, right? Let's make that really clear. Humanitarian aid that comes into Bab al-Hawara in Idlib on the border with Turkey is being taken by Al-Qaeda and is being used as part of their mafia operation to provide them with revenue. Okay, so let's make this really clear. Sanctions don't apply to the terrorists and extremist groups and the proxies of the U.S. coalition. They only apply to those people that are living under the protection of the Syrian state and its allies by choice. And you have to remember that the sanctions here are on top of policies like the burning of crops, the occupation of oil resources and the theft of those oil resources. America doesn't want the oil. It wants to deprive the Syrian people of that oil and to provide revenue for its prox-